aujourd'hui, le monde de l'islam est à l'honneur, puisqu'après une heure où on subit mes propos habituels, nous avons la chance d'avoir prolongation beaucoup plus intéressante et distinguée grâce à Madame Anna Contadini, professeure à SOAS à Londres, où elle enseigne l'art de l'islam depuis les origines jusqu'à l'époque moderne. Elle a, comme vous le savez sans doute, travaillé dans différentes collections, ce qui lui a permis d'acquérir une connaissance de première main des objets dont elle est devenue une des grandes spécialistes, participant à l'organisation de nombreuses expositions et également à des projets dont le plus récent est celui sur le griffon de Pise. Enfin, je cite le titre de Pisa Griffin and the Mitra Lion, Metalwork, Art and Technology in the Medieval Islamic Gate Mediterranean. Ses compétences en matière d'objets sont tout à fait établies, mais il ne faut pas oublier non plus la partie manuscrit, qui est sans doute notre point de rencontre le plus évident. Elle a publié le catalogue des manuscrits de la collection Halili avec Manijé Bayani et Tim Stanley, et plus récemment, en 2012, son World of Beasts, 13th Century Illustrated Book on Animals in the Ibn Battishu Tradition. Depuis longtemps, elle s'intéresse aux liens entre le monde méditerranéen et l'Europe. Pour mémoire, elle a édité en 1999 avec Charles Burnett un volume qui traite de ces questions. Mais aujourd'hui, c'est avec, bien sûr, toute l'expérience des années qui se sont écoulées depuis et des découvertes qu'elle a pu faire qu'elle nous parlera donc des relations, des liens artistiques et culturels entre le Moyen-Orient et l'Europe à l'époque de la Renaissance. Je lui cède donc la parole.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the Collège de France and for having me here. In particular, thank you to Professor François Desroches and thank you also to Professor Anna Caiozzo. It's a great pleasure to be here and an honor. Thank you all for coming. As we all know, there is no clear dividing line between the Renaissance and what preceded it. And in the present context, it is relevant to refer also to the already established patterns of contacts and acquisition that would continue to be further developed during the Renaissance. We could briefly go back to Roger II Hauteville, first king of Sicily. Born in 1095, he died in 1154. Young Roger was educated by erudite Greek and Arab tutors, and at court, Greek and Arabic were spoken in addition to Norman French and to the then emergent Italian. To him, we owe the extraordinary Palatine Chapel in Palermo. Dating from 1143, this has a typical Latin plan and glass mosaics on the walls representing biblical scenes. But at the same time, surprisingly, as we look up, we see a wooden mukarnas or stalactite formation ceiling covered by splendid paintings. This one is, for example, of a dancer, and beside it is someone who is playing a drum. They are executed in an Islamic manner, which also includes Arabic inscriptions, a testimony to the syncretic culture of Sicily during the 12th century. The Kingdom of Sicily under Roger II was characterized by its multi-ethnic nature and a degree of religious tolerance. Freedom of worship was preserved with mosques, synagogues, Byzantine Orthodox churches, and Latin cathedrals existing side by side. And the so-called Norman Arab style of art and architecture flourished. So we have, for example, the mantle of Roger II, which is a fantastic silk embroidered with gold and pearls and various other precious stones, which has a boulder with a long Arabic inscription in Kufic script, which, or angular script, or one of the scripts that Professor Desroches has studied so well, which actually dates the mantle to 1133. And we also have, in terms of architecture, an example of in San Giovanni degli Eremiti, which was a mosque, which was then changed into a church in the 12th century under Roger II. But perhaps a more common mode of contact at the period was actually warfare. And it was armed conflict that was used by the Pisans to seize booty from their raids on port cities in North Africa, Spain, and the Balearic Islands. It is most probably from Majorca that they brought back as booty an imposing bronze griffin and an Andalusian marble capital, both of which they promptly installed on the roof of their new cathedral, consecrated in 1118. The griffin was placed on the apsidal area and the capital at the end of the north transept. The griffin is now at the center of a research project I'm directing, and Professor De Roche has mentioned the publication that has just been just come out. The Gnisa document, which record the activities of Jewish merchants in Fatimid Egypt, give evidence of healthy trans-Mediterranean trade connections as far back as the 11th century. And the historical accounts of the dispersal of the Fatimid treasury from the caliphal palaces of Cairo in 1067 specifically talk of precious objects, including rock crystals, being sold in the markets. More significant elements of trade, though, were carpets and textiles, and it's not surprising to find that this fed into Italian art. The crucifix by Cimabue in San Domenico Arezzo of 1265 to 68 contained perhaps the earliest known examples of Middle Eastern textiles to be found in a Western painting. One at the back of Christ is possibly Spanish, while the other, held by the Madonna, is a mandil, a fine handkerchief, with epigraphic tiras bands in pseudo-Arabic, in angular script. Middle Eastern and Spanish Islamic textiles begin to arrive in Italy with increasing frequencies in the 13th and 14th centuries, as trade with Lucca and Pisa grew, and the early 14th century, such representations of inscriptions on luxury material continue in the Giotto frescoes in the Scrovegni Chapel of circa 1305 in Padua. Here we find textiles with pseudo-Arabic inscription in both angular and cursive script. You have here, it's not very visible on the slides, but there are many textiles that have such inscriptions. In the early 15th century, we find Hebrew in Andrea Mantegna, while Gentile da Fabriano makes considerable use of Middle Eastern elements. His adoration of the Magi, for example, is full of Oriental references, turbaned men and Arabic or pseudo-Arabic inscriptions on the luxurious textiles. Such inscriptions are also found on halos, for example, those of the Madonna and Joseph, that you can see here and here, and also on this textile. And also in the Madonna of Humility. They were previously thought, ironically, to approximate to and so to be unwittingly derived from the Shahada, the Muslim declaration of faith. But it's probable that Gentile's source was rather metalwork. The halo inscriptions resemble Ayyubid and Mamluk metalwork with regard to the layout and the core. The script is the typical thuluth used on metalwork of the period, and the text approximates to the formulaic expressions of good wishes for the Sultan, typically Izli Maulana, Sultan al-Malik al-Adil, or glory to our Lord, the Sultan, the just king, etc. Nor was the world of material culture the only forum of contact and reception, for in Renaissance Europe, an interest in the Islamic world extended to certain areas of intellectual inquiry, to languages and to disciplines such as medicine and philosophy. and there was further an openness to its technology, as witnessed the widespread adoption of the astrolabe, an appropriate example being one dated 1299 from Fez with Arabic and Latin inscriptions. As is well known, Middle Eastern scholarship, including classical scholarship mediated through Arabic, had provided an important part of Europe's intellectual landscape since the 12th century, when Latin translations were made of important texts by such major figures as Al-Farabi or Al-Farabius, Ibn Sina or Avicenna, and Ibn Rushd or Averroes. In Italy, the knowledge and teaching of Arabic was fostered by such institutions as the Scola Medica Salernitana, which flourished in Salerno between the 10th and the 13th centuries. This was the earliest medieval medical school in southern Italy, and the city of Salerno was the most important source of medical knowledge in Western Europe at the time. Much of this was based on Arabic material. For example, the 11th century Taqwim al-Sikha, or Almanac of Health, by the Iraqi physician Ibn Butlan, from which derives the Taqwinum Sanitatis, while the book on the properties of plants by Dioscorides, translated in Baghdad in the 9th century from Greek into Arabic by Hunayn ibn Ishaq and a Greek collaborator, Istifan ibn Basil, was then translated from the Arabic into Latin. These two treatises were to remain the basis for pharmaceutical and herbal writing in Europe until the end of the 16th century, accompanied by the increasingly voluminous commentaries of the Italian physician Pier Andrea Mattioli. In Spain, around 1300, we encounter an important but little-known Arabic-Latin dictionary, probably commissioned by the religious authorities in order to help in the conversion of Muslims. In the late 14th century, it was acquired by Niccolò de Niccoli, a Florentine humanist scholar, thereby entering the philological world within which the study of Arabic was to develop. During the Renaissance, we witness, accordingly, both a growing awareness of its importance alongside the biblical Semitic languages and an increasing humanistic concern with the culture it expressed. Scholars sought fresh manuscripts and produced new editions and translations, and the study of Arabic was recognized as a desideratum alongside Greek and Hebrew. The major area of concern remained, though, medicine and philosophy, and the treatise on medicine, Qanun fi Tib, by Avicenna, was to remain on the syllabus of many European universities until well after 1600, with more than one translation being printed in Venice during the 16th century. Unless commissioned by a wealthy patron, works in the original must have been uneconomical to print. We have, nevertheless, a copy of a Quran printed in 1537-38 in Venice, one of the earliest instances of movable type being created for Arabic. It was in the possession of Teseo Ambrogio degli Albonesi, who lived between 1469 and 1540, a renowned scholar of Near Eastern languages, and we can see his annotations and also in some places his interlinear translation into Latin. You can see them here. Such intellectual endeavors extended and deepened lines of inquiry and speculation central to Renaissance thinking, and seemed to provide a parallel to the commercial strands that joined Renaissance Italy to the world of Islam. But do they? We have yet to find evidence to indicate that the aesthetic appreciation of Middle Eastern artifacts was conceptualized in ways connected with the world of ideas and scholarship, or that the Renaissance scholar perceived the Ottoman desk rug that adorned his studio as products of a culture the alterity of which demanded intellectual attention. In fact, I find a surprising lack of commentary on the foreign nature of Middle Eastern artifacts, and we'll come to this a bit later. By interpreting the reaction of the West towards the Middle East as fundamentally antagonistic, traditional scholarship has failed to give due weight to such positive aspects of contact. Without wishing to deny times of tension and the realities of war, for present purposes, we may remark upon the simple fact that during the Renaissance, trade continued even during periods of war, if by different routes, just as it had during the Middle Ages, when rock crystal artifacts, for example, were acquired and displayed, their beauty enhanced by the addition of sumptuous mounts. Some may have been booty from Constantinople that went with crusader prelates to the Holy Land, thus lending them an association with holiness that could well have been reinforced by a symbolic value inspired by the play of light on the rock crystal itself. An extraordinary example is a bottle in the treasury of San Marco, carved in relief, decorated with the palmettes and scrolls typical of Fatimid Egyptian production. At some point, it was housed in a silver casket, and in the mid-13th century, it was mounted on a gold chalice by Venetian goldsmiths, enhancing the supreme preciousness of the relic and allowing it to be displayed. But the bottle has an Arabic benedictory inscription around the neck, Baraka wal Eids, or benediction and glory. You can see it here, carved in relief. And a Latin inscription around the gold band of the mount, which says, Hic est sanguis Christi. This is the blood of Christ, which is here. So this is the famous reliquary of the Holy Blood. The complex process of transformation that this group of objects initiates is one affecting both functions and perceptions, and was facilitated by extensive trading networks that both responded to demand and stimulated it. We certainly need to look at the Mediterranean less in terms of large-scale power blocks and more in terms of a patchwork of commercial and cultural centers participating in complex but loosely structured trading arrangements. In this context, the Italian city-states, and especially the maritime republics, were to become increasingly important. Middle Eastern artifacts were transmitted not only through Sicily and southern Italy, but also through the commercial and diplomatic activities of Genoa, Pisa, Lucca, Siena, Florence, Amalfi, and of course, Venice. The documents in the Venetian archives tell us that one of the biggest yearly expenses of the Republic, starting already in the 13th century, was the import of precious textiles from various parts of the Middle East, for example, Egypt, Syria, and Iran. But there were also sources further afield, textile from Central Asia and China, especially silks, were imported in great numbers by Florentine and Sinese merchants. And they were the drappi Tartari e Turchi mentioned by Dante in the Inferno, where the horrible demon Geryon is rendered beautiful by garments compared with colorful Tartar and Turkish cloths. With the rise of the Ottomans as the major power of the Islamic world, Turkish centers of production came increasingly to the fore. And with the conquest of Constantinople in 1453, the newly dominant position of Ottoman Turkey attracted a strong Italian mercantile presence. The number and activity of Italian merchants and overseas agents increased considerably. Merchants' orders could be very precise and might even be placed for a particular design, a mark of individuality indicating sensitivity to fashion and taste. A patrician family sometimes required the inclusion of its coats of arms, as is testified by a document related to a commission for Lorenzo il Magnifico. The agent Carlo Baroncelli writes in a letter from Istanbul dated 1473 that the table carpet with the coat of arms ordered by Lorenzo was taken a long time to make, and that in the meantime he hopes to send him some dogs, Saluki dogs, evidently attempting to placate him. Instructions for carpets commissioned by Italian families could also be very precise with regard to both type and to dimensions. And an insight into taste is provided by Florentine and Venetian documents. There was an overwhelming popularity of Turkish rugs with the motif of a repeated wheel pattern, which in Italian is called a ruote, that have long been labeled Holbein rugs, as they appear in the paintings of this artist. They were so fashionable, indeed, that one customer wanting variety insisted, "Non li voglio a ruote," I don't want them with the wheel pattern. As this suggests, the carpet trade could be complex and involve delicate negotiations, and on occasion a commission could give rise to acrimonious disputes. One such, in the mid-16th century, involved a Venetian intermediary in Cairo who eventually promised to procure better quality rugs, but perhaps feeling a bit homesick, required payment not just in ducats, but also in good quality sausages. Rugs were not, though, just the preserve of patrician families, and I find this very interesting, and the church. The available variety with regard to both size and quality meant that more modest individuals are also recorded as owners. At the time of Lorenzo Magnifico, the price of a large rug might be 8 to 10 florins, while a good quality small rug would cost 3 to 4 florins, rather more incidentally than a piece of Chinese porcelain, celadon or blue and white, which was surprisingly cheap, costing an average of 1 to 2 florins. Yet a small rug was not beyond the reach of the lower strata of society. The price of a small size carpet corresponded approximately to 3 months' pay of a wool worker who is recorded to have bought some. And for an artisan, even medium-sized rugs were affordable. So disposable income thus fed a thriving trade that supported weaving in both Anatolia and Egypt. To Ottoman Cairo can be assigned this remarkable cruciform carpet. Its surface is divided by bands into a large central square from which emanate 4 rectangular flaps, but they're all woven into a single piece. When bought by the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1883, it was thought to have been a canopy for use in processions, but its cruciform shape indicates rather that it was intended to cover a small square table, a use quite alien to the Islamic world, but common in the West. With its Cairene technique, Turkish ornamentation, and European shape and function, this commission represents a striking convergence of cultural forces and also demonstrates the effectiveness of the economic networks that underpinned it. But let's now concentrate on the responses to the different categories of artifacts as they variously maintain their original function, inspire emulation, are transformed, or are represented in other media. In the West, carpets, for example, were not usually intended to be walked on. And the carpets at the feet of the Madonna are a special case as they demarcate a holy space. Although they could be arranged around the bed, documents tell us that they were more normally used to cover furniture, in particular beds, benches, tables, and chests. And the visual record testifies to the high regard in which they were held. A scholar saint, an ancient philosopher, or a Renaissance humanist or merchant is often represented in his study, surrounded not only by books, but also by various symbolic objects, including ones of Middle Eastern origins, such as astrolabes, various types of metal bowls, pomanders, and typically a beautiful carpet that covers the table. In the frontispiece painting attributed to Botticelli's school, dated circa 1475, a prominent small pattern Holbein carpet is placed on the ledge of the window in front of the humanist scholar Cristoforo Landino. In the case of Hans Holbein's painting of a merchant in his study, you can see a Turkish carpet and a metal pomander of clear Middle Eastern derivation with its inlay arabesque design. Named after Hans Holbein, who depicted this type in many of his paintings, these Turkish carpets appear a half century or so before the Lotto carpets, named after Lorenzo Lotto. Turning to fabrics, although silks and velvets were traded westwards in significant quantities, the visual record points to them more as luxury commodities. Particularly striking is the degree to which they provided an impetus towards the creative development of design. An interest in Middle Eastern ornament starts to be felt particularly keenly during the Renaissance. With Middle Eastern motif of knots and stars being used, for example, by Leonardo da Vinci and Albrecht Dürer, and this is one of the six knot drawings of or prints of Albrecht Dürer after his travel to Venice in 1505, 1506, where he saw the knots and stars that Leonardo da Vinci had painted in the Sala delle Asse in the Castello Sforzesco in Milan in 1498. In the first half of the 16th century, pattern books, such as those of Peter Flettner and Francesco da Pellegrino, include large sections of Oriental motifs, called Moresque by Flettner and Façon Arabique by Pellegrino. Such terms are used generically to encompass a variety of styles without attempting to identify specific origins. Crucially, they form part of the global vocabulary of ornament, no longer tied to specific origins or contexts, that can be transferred between media and creatively combined in new ways. It's the very eclecticism of Venetian Islamicizing bookbinding designs that serves it as a diagnostic tool to distinguish them from their Ottoman counterparts, which have an austere unity of design. Let us take as an example this splendid Venetian binding containing the document of appointment by Doge Alvise Mocenigo of Girolamo Mula as Procuratore of San Mark in 1572. The binding is in Ottoman style with a typical arrangement of a central medallion, corner pieces, and filled by scrolls of arabesques. But apart from the Lion of San Mark with the Mocenigo coat of arms on the back, it happily integrates elements of Renaissance ornament. The populated border combines birds, insects, and grotesque figures. A comparable discussion of Ottoman receptivity to European art and architecture would require another lecture, but let me briefly touch upon one related aspect, the reciprocal imitation and invention of fabric design. Ottoman production of silk fabrics was concentrated in the West Anatolian town of Bursa, and Italian merchants traded there throughout the 15th and 16th centuries, but more for raw silk to be taken back to Italy for the local weaving industry or to be traded on to France or the Netherlands. Earlier reliance on imported luxury textiles was thus largely replaced by local production. In fact, Italy became a major source of silk fabrics for the Ottoman court and upper strata. One imperial kaftan, possibly for Osman II, the design of which closely resemble a velvet in Turin, seems to be of 16th century Italian, probably Florentine manufacture. And the velvet is extraordinarily similar to the one worn by Eleonora de Toledo de' Medici in the portrait of her by Bronzino. Both contain further design elements that could be read as either Spanish or Italian. The suggestion, therefore, is of a constantly shifting pattern of exchanges, both at the level of trade and at the level of design, with pattern elements from one part of the Mediterranean been incorporated in a fabric designed in another, they might then be exported to an appreciative buyer in a third. While Italians copied Ottoman designs, the Ottomans returned the compliment. In reaction to the market success of fashionable Italian designs, Ottoman looms began to produce fabrics virtually indistinguishable from them. And the degree of mutual imitation is such that certain pieces are difficult to assign with any certainty to either an Ottoman or an Italian place of manufacture. At the same time, the circulation of style features could inspire local specialization. Thus, the Ottoman industry developed its own style of brocaded velvets, one that could compete on price in Italy. Typical of the output of Bursa is this Chatma velvet, probably 16th century. Its pattern, an ogival lattice that provides a framework for rows of staggered floral motifs, presents us with another instance of the complex diffusion of a particular design feature. Its origins are ultimately to be found in East Asia, but it's likely that the Ottomans' adaptation of it in the 15th century was indebted less to Eastern than to Italian models, such as seen in this Italian velvet of circa 1500. A similar complexity concerns the transfer of flower motifs, in this case the carnation, a recognizable species rather than an unreal hybrid creation. The impetus may have come from illustrated European herbals and books of floriculture, but it certainly acquired a distinctively Ottoman form, taking on a rather abstracted, fan-like shape. So by introducing an Eastern note into a rather Italianate format, velvets such as this would have held considerable appeal, filling a particular niche within a common ground of overlapping taste in Italy and the Ottoman Empire that encouraged the production of goods for export on both sides. The above discussion, which touches on acquisitions and exchanges, on transcultural cross-fertilization and competition, essays a move away from traditional art historical scholarship towards, it is hoped, a more productive engagement with the context within which artifacts were produced and consumed, and also with the ways in which they were perceived, however faint the traces. It may indeed be argued that the very notion of a meaning associated with alterity is suspect, and that a Middle Eastern place of production for a given artifact might be incidental, even insignificant. As we have seen, the international appeal of certain types of artifact results in an eclectic sharing of features, with motifs becoming detached from their original contexts to be integrated creatively within others. By the second quarter of the 16th century, this shared range of ornament had become an integral part of the Italian or Italianate stylistic repertoire. And to that extent, it would seem not fruitful and not instructive to continue talking about influences, exoticism, or imitations. While still setting Italian ornament within a larger Mediterranean as well as European style world, it would be more pertinent to consider it as a productively hybrid domain. Relevant here is to consider emic perceptions. As far as design is concerned, we may detect in Renaissance vocabulary a gradual diminution in the signaling, not of Middle Eastern connections, but of non-European otherness. For example, I find a surprising lack of commentary on the foreign nature of both Middle Eastern objects and the arabesque. Sabba da Castiglione, humanist writer between 1580 to 1554, in chapter 109 of his Ricordi, which was first written in 1549, puts objects from the Levant on a par with a wide range of objects listed to adorn the home. Alcuni altri apparano e adornano le loro stanze di panno, di razza e di celoni venute di Fiandra, fatti a figure e a fogliami, chi a verdure e chi con tappeti moschetti turcheschi e soriani, e chi con carpette e spalliere barbaresche, chi di tele di mano di buoni maestri, chi con curami ingegnosamente lavorati venuti di Spagna, e alcuni altri con cose nuove, fantastiche e bizzarre, ma ingegnose venute di Levante o d'Alemagna. So tapestry from Flanders, Turkish and Syrian carpets and leathers from Spain are listed along with fantastic, strange novelties from the Levant and Germany. In sum, Sabata Castiglione offers us a discriminating eclecticism that encapsulates the Renaissance eagerness to acquire goods from a wide variety of sources, and hints likewise at the potential they provide for designers to creatively recombine new elements, showing both their inventiveness and their eagerness to innovate in ways that would maximize market opportunities. But perhaps even more intriguing is his integration of these disparate elements within a cultural vision with an ethical dimension. For he concludes that all these ornaments, and he actually uses the word ornamenti, are to be commended and praised because they sharpen the intellect, induce politeness, civility, and courtliness. E tutti questi ornamenti ancora commendo e laudo perché arguiscono ingegno, politezza, civiltà e cortigianeria. Merci.